You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living.
Welcome to Radiant Creators. Today we're talking to Pascal Badar. He is a writer, naturalist, and self-styled culinary alchemist based in Los Angeles. His passion is to study wild edibles and research new culinary uses through ancient traditional methods of food preservation as well as contemporary cooking techniques. Pascal has written two books, The New Wildcrafted Cuisine and The Wildcrafting Brewer. Both are Amazon bestsellers in several categories, and he has new ones that he's working on. His philosophy is that conscious wildcrafting should be in harmony with the environment, that we can gather what we need and then also make the environment even better through doing so. When you harvest one plant, be sure to plant the seed. Our relationship with nature can be more than just monocropping and clear cutting. He's doing great work. Welcome, Pascal. Well, we have your book here, The New Wildcrafted Cuisine. It's hardback, 432 pages of culinary ideas and over 600 beautiful photos. So I have to comment, who was your photographer? I mean, the photos in this book really are, I've never seen a more beautiful book on gathering or even, you know, plant identification. This is probably the most beautiful book I've ever seen in any genre like it.
Cool. So I was my own photographer.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So have you put time and effort into learning to be that good of a photographer, or is it just natural?
This is interesting. It's part of my background. So I grew up in Belgium. You know, if you want to know my background a little bit, I grew up in Belgium, and foraging was completely part of my life at the time. My grandma used to know some wild plant and send me all the time to go get nettles, hazelnut, walnuts, and all this stuff. And we had a huge garden too, but basically wild food was kind of like an addition to the garden in terms of food. And it was something that you didn't even consider odd, by the way. It was really completely normal that you go in nature and get nettles or get walnuts and stuff like that, lamb's quarter. And I really wanted to do what I'm doing right now when I was a kid, but my grandma only knew maybe, I would say, like 25 to 30 plants. So the knowledge was already getting lost a little bit. And I could not find any school in Belgium at the time. So I grew up in Belgium. I could not find any school, and I tried, and I ended up, instead of studying plants, I ended up becoming studying art. And I did the Academy of Fine Art. So I studied photography, painting, sculpting, and all this stuff. And I was a graphic artist for 25 years.
Interesting how those synchronicities work out, because the photography in the book really takes it to the next level. The average American eats like no more than 6 to 8 different vegetables, if that, and sometimes even 6 to 8 different foods, depending on how you categorize them. So,
interesting.
Yeah, none of those foods are actually oftentimes local to their area that they're living. So it's 6 to 8 different foods that are from all over the world. And factory farming, I've always thought, is bad for animals, but also something that gets missed is that there is a factory farming of plants, of crops. The huge monocrop is not necessarily good for the environment at all either. It definitely is no way to live in harmony with the environment.
Well, if you take a look in, growing up in Belgium, I would say 80% of the forests of Belgium are completely gone due to two things, urban expansion and agriculture. I went back to Belgium after 25 years to say hi to my dad, and even the little forests that were left were completely gone. So it was due to agriculture. It's interesting. It is what it is. I don't know. it's really the problem. Basically, if you think about it, monocrops are you're basically taking native land, you remove all the native land, some of them which are really edible, if you think about it, and then you replace them with non-native plant, and that becomes the food that you eat. A good example would be black walnuts, for example. I was collecting some black walnuts, and then somebody told me, oh, it's in danger. I'm like, yeah, I know it's in danger, that's why I use them, and that's why I plant them too. Because if you don't use them, this is what happens. People don't care about it. They disappear. Nobody's going to use them. They don't have any importance. Somebody buy a house, destroy the trees. I mean, you name it. So if plants are not used, you know, they will eventually disappear. And monocropping is also one of the problems. I see a danger for nature, for what I do.
Yes, because people don't have a connection to nature, and I would say sometimes often really their health or their physical bodies. Their emotions and their minds. There's a big disconnect, and it seems that feeling of place, they don't actually live anywhere. They might live in a neighborhood, but that's somewhat generic. That neighborhood could be anywhere. There's no real connection to life in it. There's no connection to as you put it, you call it terrier.
The terroir.
Okay. Yeah. Well, how would you... So what would you say about that need for the human to have that connection to live in, to walk in, to be aware of their terroir?
Yeah. So it's interesting. And by the way, I have nothing against farming, but I'm more into like organic farming.
Yeah.
Instead of the huge monocrop that you see and you know, of what, wheat, corn and all this stuff. But my definition of terroir is pretty much what is available in the environment as of 2018, for example. If I go outside in my environment, something that is not farmed is completely wild. This is actually the terroir. It's composed of native plant, and it's also composed at this point of non-native plants that have been imported from Europe or different countries for the last 300 or 400 years, I guess. But for me, this is the terroir. This is where, you know, the real flavor of a place are in nature. You know, even if you go to the supermarket in New York or Los Angeles or whatever, a lot of the food is really imported from different locations. Although in California, we actually grow a lot of things, you know. But, you know, my viewpoint is, or my interest is really to be able to create food that is a representation of an environment. So I live in Southern California, and my passion is really kind of like to, you know, really explore all those flavor and the taste that you cannot find anywhere else. There is no way you can buy that at the store, for example. I calculated last time there's probably 700 different ingredients I can collect from the wild. And most of them are actually non-native.
I think of our public lands here in America that we can roam. And the people who have interest in those really are the people who use them. And I don't have anything against hikers. I love them. But they tend to walk in and walk out. But there's not the same interest in the land as I would say hunters and gatherers have.
Right.
They really tend to be the ones who are helping to keep the public lands alive and keep interest in them and promote interest in them. And so I like the work that you're doing because you're actually creating more interest in the public lands, because really if people don't spend time in them, don't actually get something from them, then unfortunately all public lands eventually become a parking lot, and then there's just it's not good. So something I'm interested in is you have been foraging for quite a while, definitely, and you're doing it for a living now, which is wonderful, and you do teach walks in the woods, courses on it. We'll talk about those a little bit more soon. Foraging is becoming a culinary trend in restaurants. You mentioned that, and I'm wondering, do you see that trend increasing, and like, what role are you playing in that? Are you actually working, you actually have worked with restaurants to help to, and chefs to help to broaden their...
So it's interesting. It was an interesting experiment. I actually stopped working with restaurants like 2 years ago. For two reasons. One, it was really exhausting. Two, one of the issues that I went into is that a lot of the chefs were interested to use wild food because it was something very trendy. But they didn't know what to do with it if I was bringing them like some exotic food. And very often they will ask me to bring them wild food that will work within their cuisine. So if you're a French chef, you want very common wild food like chickweed, dandelion, and stuff like that. So it was kind of boring, to be honest, because I didn't find a chef that actually say, this is super interesting. I really want to explore the local flavor and see what we can do with it. I was basically a food provider, but there was not that, I didn't see that passion or that really desire to explore. The only one who was a little bit different, and I worked with her for 2 years, was Nikki Nakayama from a Naka restaurant. She's a very famous chef, and she's the only chef who will actually come with me in nature to connect with the plant and the environment.
The fear of mushrooms, and maybe the fear of foraging in general, eating something that you gather in nature, where'd that fear come from, do you think? Because it's definitely deliberately put there.
You know, it's interesting if you think about it. You know, by the way, a lot of the public that come to my classes are actually hikers. It's interesting. So you humans right now live in a city. You know, I live in Los Angeles, so those people here live in a very, very complex environment. But they are actually able to do so many things, like read signs, understand how to travel, how to take the subway if necessary, the car schedule, the metro, and all this stuff. So there is so much complexity that people are actually able to process. But suddenly they go hiking and go in nature and they don't know anything anymore. They don't know what those plants are. They don't know what to do with them. It's completely backward. If you think about it, 100 years ago, people knew pretty much, a lot about nature. But when you would put them in Los Angeles right now, they would get completely lost, like not knowing what to do. And now you have people who are completely educated and really knowledgeable on what to do in a city and how to get around and where to go, where you get your food and all this stuff. But you put them back in nature, they're completely lost. So all this is, you know, within one or two generations, all this knowledge has been probably like three generations. All this knowledge has been lost. So my role, the way I see it, is really to educate back people. And a lot of my publics are actually hikers and people who are into food. But the hikers, they actually come to me because they say, we are actually walking, you know, for like 1 hour every day or 2 hours every week in nature, and we are surrounded by things. We have no clue what they are. We don't know their name, and we don't know what to do with them. You know, it's kind of fascinating.
Time in nature is speaking to them to go deeper, to know more.
Totally.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I like to teach, because frankly, one of my biggest problem as a forager, I call myself a wild crafter in Los Angeles, is really the chemical, like people, the city spraying or the park and recreation spraying chemicals, and also people trashing places. I would say in 15 years, I probably lost 5 miles of place where I used to go forage, because I would not touch them anymore. It's so trashy. And it's mostly because people don't care about nature. They just go into nature to like hide and drink beer or whatever and just trash the place. It's just no respect. And if you don't know something, or if you don't know how valuable things are, then you're not going to respect them. And I can tell you that when I teach people, you know, what nature can offer and can do for them, you know, they actually really take care and start, you know, when I go foraging, I always have a bag with me and I pick up the trash, you know, if I see some. You know, I still love my student doing that too.
From your bio in your book, The New Wildcrafted Cuisine, I believe it says, as a forager, you must assume the role of being a steward of the land. If you do so, the rewards will be plentiful.
Yeah.
So you're not only taking from the land, you're a steward of it. It is yours to take care of.
Yeah, totally. Like, for example, yesterday I collected the black walnuts and I will use 20% and replant them because black walnuts are actually getting rare. You know, so that's one way you actually can help the environment. My viewpoint on foraging after, you know, it's been a learning experience over the years, but my viewpoint on foraging right now is foraging should be done in such a way that it is actually good for the environment. It is completely possible. Here in Los Angeles, we are completely surrounded by, more than 100 edible plants that are non-native, and some of them are invasive. If you come here in LA and you take a look at the hills in Los Angeles in May, they are completely yellow from mustard flowers. Now, it's interesting because some of those mustard actually crop in different countries, but here in Southern California, they are viewed as non-native and invasive. So there are two solutions. Either you uproot them and cut them and try to get rid of them, or you use chemicals on them. So, but they are not eaten either way. And if you think about it, you have people in Los Angeles who cannot afford good food, and we are completely surrounded by organic food that the city and, you know, is actually interested to get rid of. There are no solution there. There is no dialogue between, you know, the city and the possibility of using all those resources as food so that you can actually help native plant to come back too. It's a very interesting dilemma, and I'm really, from my perspective right now as of 2018, I'm going like, you know what, foraging should be done in such a way that you really help the environment, you really concentrate all on those very nutritious but also non-native and invasive plant, and then you can still use a native plant but plant them.
You mentioned pick a whole plant. If you pull it, be sure to plant the seed in the same hole.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's something I think that I have never actually seen mentioned in any foraging book I've ever seen. So that's something very unique to the work that you're putting out, is that holistic perspective that foraging can be a stewardship and it can be good for the land. It isn't this one-sided just taking. It's actually a holistic teaching, which is something that definitely attracted me to your work for sure.
Yeah, it's the way people used to do it in the old days. Not only native people, but, you know, when I study the old European culture, Celt, Viking, and all this stuff, you know, people always had a very deep connection with nature, and it was never in their interest to actually take too much from the environment. And then when farming came, it completely changed everything.
Oh, everything changed quite a lot. And I would say, since this is the country I'm most familiar with, America, it really was about the 1750s where you see a lot of that change. That's when the environment became a commodity. That's when buffaloes became buffalo tongues and buffalo skins. You know, that's when we started to expand quite a bit and take monocrops with us across the land. So that was a huge change. Why do you think people litter in nature? And I'll just tell you, my thought real quick is I think it's a disconnection, of course, from nature. When you see the land as something out there, when you're in the land and you see the land and you are the land, then you get it. But until then, you're going to litter in nature because it's not you.
It's interesting, and I actually did a survey because I was so mad about it. I started talking to people who were trashing places. Literally, I went to them and talked to them. And there is different ethnic groups. It's a cultural thing. And when I was talking to them, sometimes the answer that I got was pretty much that somebody else is going to take care of it. And it was cultural. Like, they basically there, they do their thing, drink their beer, whatever, and then they just leave everything there, and somebody else is going to come around and clean it for them. This is expected. This is what's happening. It's not a bad thing because it gives a job to somebody else. It's kind of lazy, but there is definitely sometimes a cultural thing there too, which I didn't know until I started talking to people.
I understand that mentality 100% in a public park, you know, where there are trash cans and somebody actually does come and clean it up. I understand that in a Walmart parking lot.
I agree with you.
But in nature, it's just a very different situation.
Yeah. Totally, but it's still the same, you know. It basically was the same consideration as if you were at the beach. Like, somebody's going to take care of it. You know, I mean, it's lazy. It's not very, you know, educated. But it was what it was. That's what the kind of answer I was getting from people when I was asking them.
That's really something. I also find that it was called Sand County Almanac, and I forget the author's name, but he wrote how when we see a map now and we see this, you know, green spot between cities, we consider that undeveloped. You know, do you know what I mean? As if that doesn't have value. It's like only these cities have value, and that green spot in the middle, well, it doesn't have value. So it seems that also part of that littering to me is not understanding the value of those parts of the map that are green and maybe have dirt roads going through them, if any roads at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. And to be honest, you know, I know that by myself I'm not making a dent, you know, but the only thing I do is I have a real passion for nature and also discovering what the land can offer and the unique flavor that the land can offer. But I realized, you know, I'm not making a dent. I'm just by myself. My only hope is that through my teaching and the books, you know, I can get people to view nature and read what it can offer to you and the possibilities, you know, in terms of diet, you know, and the food that you can get from it in a way that it can even help the environment, which is even more fantastic. I mean, if you think about it, like in... If I go in May, I go to the store and I decide to buy some salad. How much choice do I have? Probably, I would say, 4 or 5 different kinds of salads in Los Angeles. If I go in nature in May, I probably can collect enough edible greens in 20 minutes to feed 10 people. No problem. And I probably will collect over 15 different edible greens, which are really, which have very, very complex flavor. So it's interesting because we think, you know, the vast majority think that they have a freedom of choice in terms of food. They go to the supermarket and go like, yeah, I have freedom of choice. I can decide what I want to eat. But again, if you want to buy potatoes, you're going to have a choice of 5 potatoes, for example. How many potatoes exist in the world? How many kind of potatoes exist in the world? 10,000. Approximately 10,000. It's crazy. Why do we have only 5?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty much russet, sweet potatoes, red potatoes. Yeah. Maybe if the supermarket's very daring, they have purple potatoes.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm lucky. I'll be honest, because I live in Los Angeles. It's a big city, and we have a lot of ethnic market. You know, so I have access to very exotic food, you know, because of those ethnic market. But most other American city probably would not have, you know, what's available to me. You know, in New York, probably, yes, you also have a lot of ethnic market. But it's fascinating. People think they have a freedom of choice in terms of food, but they really don't. You know, it's... In terms of flavor, it's the same thing. You know, you basically are offered a very specific choice in such a way that you think that you have freedom. But it's not your choice. You know, you can, if I go to Whole Foods and say, can I please have some black sage seeds, you know, they're going to look at me going like, what? Can I have some lamb's quarter seeds? What? You know, so, yeah.
Yeah, I think there you can get chai seeds, you can get flax seeds, but that's about, yeah. You know, maybe some mustard seeds.
Yeah, but again, the mustard seeds, you know, this is so easy to collect in nature locally. We have black mustard seeds. I can collect, you know, several cups in one morning.
That's amazing. Yeah, I like to grow mustard greens in the cold frames in the winter. They're one of my favorite winter crops, and they're so potent and powerful. And the value of finding a spot in nature, whatever that is for an individual, it might be a park, it might be, you know, really getting out into the forest. It varies for different people. Not everyone has the same access. But wherever that is, as close as you can get, the value of finding that spot and experiencing the seasons and the importance of connecting to a place, season, the food, what do you think that offers a person? Because it really seems like we talked to Arthur Haynes a little while back, a great guy when it comes to rewilding, and he was saying that to find a place that you know and then get to know it through all of the seasons, and then if you can add foraging, I mean, what does that offer the human who is domesticated? What does that offer? What starts to change in that person?
Okay, so that's interesting, because I'm probably more unusual than some of the people you have on your interview, because I'm not like a rewilding guy. I'm not, teaching primitive skill or survival skills or anything like that. But what I have, or what I try to teach, is this balance between living in the city and nature. I'm basically a fantastic example that you can live in the city and be very, very, very connected to nature. It takes a couple of hours every day, and, you know, even 1 hour going hiking for 1 hour in a day, and my God, you can do so much. You know, you can collect seeds, you collect acorns, you can collect dandelion, mustard. And the amount of culinary stuff you can do is unbelievable. I mean, since that book, you know, so you have the New Wildcrafted Cuisine, I wrote The Wildcrafting Brewer, which is all about, because of course, when they read the first book, a lot of people were interested in the beer, making the wild beer, which I love. I mean, it's fantastic. So I wrote a whole book on fermentation, alcoholic fermentation, but also how to make sodas, beer, meads, always wild plant and using the yeast that you can find in nature. Locally, I mean, it's so easy to do. We have wild cherries. We have a lot of invasive trees that, that we find in nature. Last time I found some plums. We have figs all over the place in California that grows in nature. So I wrote that book, and then right now I'm actually working on a book about lacto-fermentation of wild edible. And I'm really going deep. You can see on Facebook and Instagram, as I'm like completely obsessed with fermentation for the next 6 months now. But I'm really going deep on how you can use plants, and I'm really trying to focus now on those really non-invasive and invasive plants, because I'm really fed up with all the chemicals that are being sprayed. It's kind of like my revenge. I'm like, I want to make foraging so popular that people will not think about spraying anymore. But all those plants are like so nutritious, and lacto-fermentation is an incredible way to explore the flavor. You know, for example, black mustard or regular mustard, the root, you uproot the plant, which is good. That's what you want to do. It's an invasive one. So you uproot the plant. There is no way you can eat the root. It's tough. But if you scrape it or crush it, and you smell it, it's like it has wasabi quality. I mean, it's like very, very potent. So my solution, and I could not do that, I could not find a solution before I look at lacto-fermentation, is I take those roots and I actually crush them, and then I will mix them with spice, brine made of salt, and different spices and put the root inside to macerate and actually ferment, kind of like making a root kimchi. And it's an incredible ferment. It makes the most incredible soup. You can use it in soup. You can also use it in salad dressing. But I'm amazed. Like, I'm amazing myself by discovering all those flavors that I had no idea through the lacto-fermentation process. So if you, there are so many different ways of preserving food. You can take one plant and apply 20 different food preservation techniques to it. And you'll be amazed the flavor that you can discover coming out of it.
But you're definitely part of the rewilding community, because it's all about people, I guess, becoming that new Aboriginal. You know, like, it's not, and it's not becoming an Aboriginal again. It's becoming a new Aboriginal. Right. And so you're basically showing how a person can be a neo-Aboriginal, a new Aboriginal in a city. I mean, you're more connected to nature than most people who live, you know, in a very rural setting.
Because that
connection is not simply where you live; it's where you forage from where you live. So your unique take on it, I think, is super valuable, because we need lots of different angles, lots of different interests that get people into the woods, into the public lands, to hunt and gather. You know, and your perspective is so unique and well done that it's getting people out there. So you're doing more than you think. I mean, we're all doing our little thing, but how far those ripples are going, who knows? But they're definitely, you're definitely getting out there.
It's interesting. I'm talking to a different forager, and sometime, you know, because I'm so doing my own thing, you know, over here, and I'm so busy doing my own thing. That's all I do from morning to night. Yeah. You know, I sometimes, you know, don't realize that, for example, foraging for seeds is unusual. I didn't know that. I was just doing it. And then one time somebody said, you know, you foraging for seeds is unusual. I'm like, really? It's everywhere. There's probably like 200 edible seeds that you can find wild. Out of the 200, I would say 100, more than 100 are non-native. They're all food. You can use them to, you know, in bread, you can use them in soups, you can make crackers with them. I mean, there's so many different uses. You know, I usually even add them to salads and stuff. I'm doing lacto-fermentation right now. I'm doing like fermented achar, which also includes seeds. So I'm even putting some of those seeds in my fermentation. But apparently it was not very unusual for people to forage seeds. So insect is the same thing, by the way, foraging insects.
How did humans come across fermentation? Like, why do we ferment? Because it is, there's so many different fermented foods. I mean, and they're a part of our lives. We don't really know why. Don't really know where they came from necessarily. And fermentation is an odd thing. Like, how did humans come across it, and why did they bother after they did?
Well, you know, I can tell you from my perspective, and I never really look at the story of that, but from my perspective, I mean, right now you go to the supermarket, you have food all year long. In the old days, you know, and I said the old days, like if it was hunter-gatherers, some of your food will be available for maybe like 3 weeks. Like, let's say chickweed. We have chickweed here in Los Angeles. We don't have chickweed for like 1 month. That's it. Then we may get other plants, and, you know, all the season, you know, we have different things during the season. But your game, and I did that not because it's something I've read somewhere that I was supposed to do, but I did that because I had to do it if I wanted to re-explore the flavor. Your game become to find a way to preserve the food that you collect. And fermentation is probably one of the easiest way to do it. If you think about it, you know, alcohol, beer, whatever, you know, it's a food preservation technique. You have those berries, you have so much berries, or you have so much wild grapes that you don't know what to do, ferment them. There is nothing to do, by the way. The only thing you have to do is maybe add water, maybe add a little bit more sugar if you have some, but the natural yeast is already on the fruit most of the time. You take that beverage and it makes you super happy. Oh my God, you know, big discovery. You know, Alcohol is fantastic also as a painkiller too. So in the old days, very, very old days, having a painkiller was something super valuable too. Lacto-fermentation, same thing. The only thing you need is salt. So you take, you know, probably, if I look at kimchi, for example, I have not read it, but the way some of the kimchi is made is I really think that they simply used seawater in the old days and just put some of those cabbage in it with some spice and you end up with a kimchi. I've done it with seawater. You know, the only problem is I had to get the seawater all the way from Oregon because I would never touch the seawater here in Los Angeles due to pollution. But yeah, I made a kimchi like condiment just by, you know, putting my vegetables and wild food, you know, into seawater and just let it ferment that way.
And I've heard all kinds of odd stories of how, you know, humans discovered fermentation. Like, I think the early civilization between the Tigris and Euphrates River supposedly left, I think it was beer in a basket. No, I'm sorry, like wheat in a basket, and it rained on it, and they forgot about it, and, you know, beer was created. Who knows if that's true, but... Yeah. Who knows?
You know, in my opinion, it probably started with mead.
Mead?
Because mead is so easy. You know, as soon as you add a little bit of water to raw honey, you immediately get the fermentation going.
Oh,
so
okay.
That's all it is, because pure raw honey, not the raw honey you buy at the store, by the way, because it's not really raw. But pure raw honey, if you have bees, always contain wild yeast. As soon as you add water to it, you end up with fermentation.
Oh, okay. So that would actually be the process for mead then, would be raw honey from the beehive, and then just add water to that, mix it, let it sit, and you've got mead?
Yeah. So if you had, you know, I'm pretty sure you can have a scenario in the old days where you had this tree with a hole in it, which what a lot of bees like that, and it started raining. Somehow the honey fell into the water and boom, you got the mead right there inside your tree. If somebody tasted that, like if somebody crazy like me would go around, he may actually taste it and go, oh, by golly, this is fantastic. Maybe I can do more of this. But he would have to be crazy like me.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, I mean,
if I exist, I know that some people are crazy enough to do things like that.
Oh, well, craziness is like heaven, so it works out. I mean, yeah. I like that because I think mead was, back in, the 1300s or so, I think it was considered, that was like the peasant brew. If you didn't have money, that's like what the peasants were out drinking because they had honey, you know, but grapes were harder to come by, so.
Yeah, and the same thing with beer, by the way, you know, making the wild beer. I had an archaeologist that came to see me for 2 days because he was doing research on primitive beers and shamanic beer and all this stuff. And the more he was doing research, the more he was basically coming across what I was doing. So he says, that's interesting. I want to meet the guy. And he spent 2 days with me to see how I thought about doing those beer and why and how, you know, what ingredient I put in it, you know. But basically, people would have tried to preserve the food that was in the environment and would actually brew with ingredients that were found in their environment, you know. So the whole beer had nothing to do with hops and grains, to be honest. You can use some of my beer, you know, use mugwort, for example, or yarrow, which are plant that the Celt and Viking would have used instead of hops. And in terms of sugar, oh my God, I mix different things. You know, sometimes I use a little bit of grain, but sometimes I use, you know, molasses from fruits. I make my own molasses by boiling fruit juice to the point that it's pure sugar. I even use insect honeydew. I find the forest, I use a little bit of honey. So my beverage, sometimes you don't even know what to call it. Is it a beer? Is it a wine? Is it a boozy soda? Who cares, you know? Classification came later. In the old days, people were just simply happy to find stuff in the environment, preserve it, make something that makes them happy and tastes good. if you know, later on, then you know, they started naming stuff, but a lot of the naming has nothing to do with flavor. It has to do also with taxes. If you can name something, then you can write law about making it, and then you can tax it too.
As far as names, I like what you've mentioned. Boozy soda. I like that.
Boozy soda.
That's what I would call it. This is boozy soda.
You know, I go by taste, to be honest. If something tastes more like a beer, then I would call it a beer. If something tastes more like a cider, I would call it a cider. If it tastes like a wine, I would call it a wine. You know, but the public kind of decide on that. You know, but mugwort beer, for example, is definitely beer. You know, people would drink it. It's like, okay, it's a beer. You know, yarrow. So those are very, very bitter plants.
And those beers, are they medicinal at all?
It can be.
Because, I mean, I think that'd be very fun to make mugwort beer because mugwort is associated, well, in the lore as being good for dreams. So that could be, you know, dream boozy soda. I'll make that right away.
Well, it's, you know, sometime I'm like on the borderline of shamanic drink and medicinal drink too. You can do it on purpose. I mean, I can do shamanic drink no problem if I wanted to. I can forage some special mushroom and put them into the beer, and that beer is going to be very special.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'll definitely stop by for a dinner party.
I actually don't take drugs, but I mean, it will be so easy. And I know, you know, if you know nature and you know the mushroom and you know the thing, it's, you know, that's what those shamanic drinks were. You know, there's nothing complex about it. Medicinal, too. I mean, I can make medicinal beer by using, for example, willow bark as a bittering agent, which contains salicylin, which is what aspirin is. So it could reduce fever and, you know, different stuff, healing property, too. So, yeah, the potential is just unbelievable.
So you've got the new Wildcrafted Cuisine, that one, and then your other book is?
The Wildcrafting Brewer.
The Wildcrafting Brewer. I will have to get that one also.
And, then the next one, it probably will be Wildcrafted Fermentation or something like that.
Oh, I like it.
I'm on a Wildcrafted thing.
Oh, of course. I think it's great.
Do you know, that's the difference. When I started to do those books, I came out with the name. I mean, I didn't come out. The name existed. But I wanted to make the difference between foraging and wildcrafting, because wildcrafting really has this thing about taking care of nature that foraging doesn't always have. Give you some good example. You know, and very often is when money is involved. Foraging for ramps. You know, you have people who make a shitload of money foraging for ramps. They don't care. They just want the money. So it's not about taking care of the environment. They just want to get as many ramps as possible and then resell it. I've seen it in Vermont. It's terrible. Same thing with, fern, fiddlehead ferns. You know, same thing. I've seen, like, when I was in Vermont, like a whole field with all the fern cut off because foraging for money. You know? So foraging and money really don't go together. And I wanted to distance myself a little bit from the term foraging and put emphasis on the word wildcrafting. Because wildcrafting, there is not an idea of profit there. It's about working with nature, get the most out of nature, but also helping nature in such a way that you're actually creating more than you would ever take.
Yes, the wildcrafter works in harmony with the environment rather than clear-cutting it.
Yep.
You know? Yeah, that's beautiful. I've definitely, when I lived in the Pacific Northwest, I would see a truck full of workers hop out and pretty much clear cut the forest of chanterelles and et cetera, so they would just go through, and definitely there was no idea of preservation whatsoever. They really were foraging for dollars, you know.
Yeah, and I don't know about mushroom, to be honest, because I don't know if mushroom is an issue. When I talk to, you know, I'm mostly a plant guy, I'm not really a mushroom guy. And when I talk to mushroom people, they say it's not really a big issue for mushroom because the mushroom is really the fruit of the whole organism, and the whole organism is actually on the ground. So it would be like picking berries from a bush or picking elderberries from a tree. It's not going to destroy the tree.
Yeah, by the time the mushroom, you see it, it's already dropped its spores, it's done its thing. Yeah.
That's why I don't mind picking up mushroom like reishi and stuff like that. I mean, when I pick up some, I found some reishi 3 days ago, and just picking it up, like all this pollen was going all over the place.
That'd be good in a boozy soda, like reishi boozy soda.
I have a shaga beer and I think maybe a reishi beer in recipe in the Wild Crafting Brewer.
Oh my heavens! Well, I'll be ordering that right after this. I love shaga. That's one of our big ones here, shaga and reishi. So if we could ferment those in a boozy soda, that would be great, especially with the holidays coming up. So.
Doing some lacto fermentation of reishi right now, and you won't believe how it's coming up. It's like soy sauce.
Oh my gosh, like soy sauce.
You know, I found out, and I, you know, because and this is where I learned so much from writing book, because it really forces me to do so much research. You know, I found some reishi like 3-4 days ago, and here am I writing a book about fermentation. So I start researching reishi and fermentation. Boom. It's like open a whole universe. It's been used, lacto fermentation and reishi has been used in China, I think, to create like a type of umami, like a flavor enhancer for food. I could not find any recipe. I saw some scientific document, all kind of different stuff, but no recipe whatsoever. So I'm starting from scratch, you know, but I'm actually fermenting reishi using lacto fermentation, and I'm on day number 3, I'm smelling it, I'm already in love.
Well, something that I really can tell with your work, with what you're doing, is the power of play. Like, something that I can really hear that you're doing is you're having a good time.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah, and so your work really is your play. It's like Joseph Campbell said, you know, follow your bliss and doors open. Yeah. And he also mentioned that bliss is not just fun and laughter. It's wiping sweat off your brow. It's hard work. So
it's interesting. It's experimental. I mean, if you think about it, I'm doing like ferment right now. I will assume that 70% of what I do is not usable because I'm experimenting so much, you know, so it's just not good enough. When I start something that's kind of good enough, then I can start focusing on it until I get a recipe that's like super interesting. But it's a lot of fun. I don't mind failure. Every time I have a failure, I learn something new.
Doing what interests us, just following that, seeing where it takes us. That to me really is the key to happiness, is doing things that interest you. Most people who are not happy are not pursuing anything that interests them.
Yeah, well, it's one of the problems with the money system, to be honest. You know, I used to have a lot of money in the old days. I mean, I make some really good money during the internet days. I actually had 3 internet companies. I lost everything in 2001 during the internet crash. But it really made me rethink my whole life. You know, so it was 2001. I lost everything. I just got divorced. So I was 40-something, and my life was completely restarting from scratch. And I just looked at it and went, fuck money. It's just, you need money to live in this world. I mean, let's be honest, you need money, but it cannot be the goal. It cannot be having a big house. It cannot be having the best car. You know, my car has 250,000 miles on it, which is why I was late 1 hour. You know, but I started to look at life more like from a passion point of view. It has to be a passion. Life is too short. It has to be a passion. Otherwise, why living it? Being a slave from a 9-to-5, you know, to try to make money to buy a house, and then you die, and then you never got the house because you're gone anyway, you know? I don't know. I cannot think that way. It's a curse, though. I mean, it's really a curse. Let's be honest. I've been cursed.
I like that. Now, how do you define the curse? Because you're getting to play, you're getting to pursue what interests you, and that is, that creates a life of passion, but you also see it as a curse.
Yeah, it makes you so different from everybody else. So you start to be in the category of weirdos. But in a good way. I'm not, you know, but it's, you know, my lifestyle is so unusual compared to most people that I know, you know. And I've adjusted my lifestyle to what I do. I mean, as a wild crafter, it's not that you make a lot of money, to be honest, just so you know, and you're not making a lot of money from writing book. In Los Angeles, the cost of living is really, really expensive. Like renting a little one-bedroom apartment is like $1,600 a month, if you can find one. It's more in the $2,000 to $2,500 right now. I mean, as a wild crafter, how do you make that kind of money? Come on, you know. So I'm basically living in a small place, and it looks like a rich, you know, place. But I've basically cut down the expense in my life so I can live doing what I love without having to worry about money. So I have no problem paying the rent because it's cheap. I don't use a lot of electricity. I don't use, you know, I have my car. My car has 250,000 miles on it, but it's working well. It's my old Jeep. I would never change it. You know, Jeep Wrangler. That's my forging car. And I keep fixing it. It's all good. It's like, you know, but from another I can see from another perspective, you know, it's kind of like weird. I'm like spending all this time in the forest. I'm kind of making a living, eating weird things and having fun all day long, playing, you know, the owner of the place that I rent is sometimes like, look at my place and go like, what the hell are you doing? Like, she cannot comprehend what my life is, because I'm always, you know, I have all these jars of food and I have, you know, all those bottles with ferments in it. You know, in the yard, I have like my experiment right now of making this barrel of tree trunks where I can ferment stuff in it. It's a bit out there in a good way.
Stuart Wilde, a great kind of esoteric mind, he called that being a fringe dweller, where you're living on the edge of society. You're in it, kind of this world, but like, yeah, in this world, but not of it. You're only your toes are in the world, and like the rest of you isn't. And I think it might be a curse, but it's definitely a magical curse, because
it's not a bad curse.
As difficult as it is, at least there's passion in it, and that's a wonderful thing. There was an article that Stuart Wilde wrote back in 2008 called The Importance of Now, and he takes on the question, or the statement really, that now is the only time I've got, and that he called it minimal movement, where basically get rid of all things that do not serve in your life, constantly be working on that. And so it sounds like you've definitely cleared out a lot of things that don't serve. Now it's working on making lots of money with your little witchcraft cabin in the woods, you know?
No, do you know what's interesting, Maya? I think as soon as I'm done writing the book about lacto fermentation, I'm already getting, you know, it's funny that you talk about that. I'm already getting rid of a lot of stuff right now. So I want to minimalize my lifestyle a lot more. And I'm thinking about maybe starting to travel. Start to travel and teach in different locations and do a little bit of research. And maybe start writing another book. I already have an idea for next book after that, and the book will be really about exploring this idea of creating a cuisine based on non-native and invasive plants, because they are so plentiful and it is such a shame that one is not used, and also that is probably one of the reasons we have so much chemical sprayed in the city. And I'm going, this is interesting. Nobody's doing anything with this stuff. It's really edible. It's creating problem for everybody, including pollution. And I'm going like, huh. And you'll be amazed. I mean, everywhere you go, even in Vermont, you find those plants everywhere. There's nothing wrong with them, by the way. I'm not an extremist. But I'm going like, if I could create a very creative and cuisine and inspire people on really using those plants and bring them back into gourmet food, I think that would be something valuable. What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely do. You might have to get upgrade your Jeep Wrangler to like a small motorhome or something.
That's what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Motorhome.
Yeah, to make it easier to travel, kind of have a portable, you know, witchcraft vehicle. And
yeah, totally.
And
the idea is not again. I'm not like an extremist on like native versus non-native, invasive versus non-native. I'm just seeing a problem there, and I'm going like, this is a problem I can address. That would be interesting. Which is the fact that we spend so much time trying to get rid of something or spraying chemical all over the place. And believe me, I live in LA. I see it. Like, I see the amount of spraying chemical that's happening that nobody has any clue. Because I'm, like, in the middle of it. You know, I'm going to, like, maybe I can change a little bit of that. You know, that would be something valuable. People have no idea how much chemicals we're surrounded with. You know, the whole forest that you see the first book, The New Wildcrafted Cuisine, this beautiful forest I talked about, gone. Completely. Like, it's so toxic right now. They're spraying chemicals right, left, and center, trying to get rid of something called Arundodonax. They've been spraying chemicals for 2 years. I cannot touch that forest. It's toxic waste for me at this point. It's terrible.
I think what you're doing really is how we can change that, or it's the only way we can actually do anything about it, is to get people out there. I think that, you know, woods, vast expanses that have boots in them, where people are hunting and gathering. You know, I'm all for hunting. I'm a hunter and gathering. Yeah. To me, it is what's natural for humans. When people take an interest, then that's what protects those lands, because for the most part, most people, they don't have a clue what's happening out there when public lands come and go. They don't know. So I really appreciate your unique perspective on wildcrafting and that you're getting it out there, because it's getting a whole genre, a whole bunch of people interested and out there who weren't out there before. And so I think it's great. I mean, it may seem like it's a small contribution, but it's way bigger than you think. And I really look forward to you taking it on the road. That's going to be great. How about acorns? What is the history of acorns? Because hunter-gatherers, you know, native people who got sometimes certain parts of the year, like up to 50% or more of their calories from acorns, these are something that humans have seriously been munching on for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And they litter the area. I mean, and we kind of ignore them. So give us some interesting insight on acorns, and then we'll just wrap it up where people can get a hold of you and such.
So yeah, acorn is super interesting. It's, you know, it was a major food source in Europe and different country, Korea. Also, I think probably every country was using acorn if they had, you know, oak trees. Southern California, definitely a large source of, you know, one of the main food source for native people, because it was so easy to get. I think one oak tree can give you like up to 200 pounds of acorn. Why it is not in California cuisine, I have no idea. You know, speaking of California cuisine, actually, I don't know what's really native to California in California cuisine, if there is such a thing. But acorn, every year I can collect as much as I wanted if I wanted to. I mean, there is so much. The only thing you have to do is you have to process them and leach them to remove the tannin. And in the wildcrafting cuisine, I have two different methods. There's a boiling method, and there's also a cold leaching method in cold water. But guess what? For the new use for it. In the wildcrafting cuisine, I think we made some burgers and with acorn and all kind of different interesting acorn flowers, and we use them in breads and crackers and stuff like that. But guess what? Lacto-fermentation, I study how to make vegan cheese, vegan fermented cheese, and I really started to look into it to because I eat regular cheese. And I started to really look at spice and how to add flavor to those vegan cheese. And the fermentation process really brings it to a new level. I've been making acorn cheese, fermented acorn cheese with the nuts. It's absolutely unbelievable. It is so good. It will literally taste nearly like a cheese. You know, and ever since I started to work on those cheese, doing vegan cheese with local nuts and stuff like that, I would say those classes have been sold out twice a month every time. I had a vegan chef. He came to the first class and he went nuts. He went like, speaking of nuts, he went completely nuts, going like, oh my God, you know, this is incredible. And the word of mouth just went crazy. You can, you know, this is a new one. This is, again, using a food preservation technique like fermentation to a regular ingredient, and you changing it completely, you know. But you can be lazy too. You can go to the Korean store in Los Angeles and you can buy acorn flour. This is the only place where you can actually buy it, the Korean store.
Your September and October schedule is being updated, so people should definitely go to urbanoutdoorskills.com. Some of the classes that Pascal has coming up September 23rd, Wilder Fermentation, and it's a plant walk. Includes brewing wild beer with local plants, extracting wild yeast, and plant walk.
So they basically can sign up directly from the website. My email address is there. And you know, I only take 15 people per class. So it's not about the money. It's actually about the quality of instruction. So for any class that you see there, I only take 15 people per class. So it's kind of first come, first serve. And I a lot of the class gets sold out that way, but it's so much better than, you know, trying to get like 30 people or whatever. It's just not good. So it's not about the money. It's about quality of instruction. It's more fun. It's more hands-on. And, you know, I never take more than 15 people.
That is massively altruistic. That is great. Well, it has been amazing having you on the show. I totally appreciate it. Thanks for showing up. And we will get this posted in the next day or so. And I will send you a link to it when we do.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And hopefully we will talk to you again sometime.
Oui, oui, oui.